I stumbled upon this very different orientation to coaching that's very physically oriented, very experiential, very mind-body applied. At one point, as I was training in this methodology, in interacting with someone, it was like everything went quiet inside of me. And I wouldn't say I heard a voice, but I had a knowing. And if I were to put that knowing into words, I would say the knowing in words was, oh, this is my work. This is my work. And interestingly, it harkened back to what I had done in my undergraduate education, which I had really loved, but which didn't necessarily equip me for like a normal job. So here I am with a very abnormal job that I've created and invented myself. But it brings in all of my childhood interests, my college level interests, and even the stumbling around that I did early in my career that was more in the world of business, where I could start to bring together mind-body science, applied learning and behavioral change, and take all of that as a lever to help people improve their lives.
Welcome. I am your host, Dino Cattaneo, and you're listening to Authentic Leadership for Everyday People, the podcast where we investigate the connection between effective leadership and authenticity. If you're looking for inspiration and tips on how to become a better leader by being your true self, you're in the right place. Last week, we talked about the fighter pilot leadership mindset with Christian Boukassis, CEO Afterburner. Christian told us how he took the principles he learned as a fighter jet pilot for the Royal Australian Air Force, and now he teaches them to organizations to help them improve their business. Today, we talk to Dr. Amanda Blake, Mandy, as many people call her. She integrated her experience in biology, neuroscience, business, teaching, and somatic learning to develop a unique approach to developing leaders that is based on the connection between body and brain. As a matter of fact, she's also the author of the book, Your Body is Your Brain, where she discusses her methodology in depth. Our conversation started with a very honest discussion of the path it took her to find her true calling. And there were a few interesting learnings in that conversation if you're still in search of the career that fulfills your purpose. Of course, we also discussed some of the key principles that inform body-mind development. We close with a couple of practical examples of practices that you can adopt right now to have your body inform your mind. And I even did an exercise in real time. So enjoy the show. Mandy, welcome. Let's start this conversation like everyone of this podcast. Please tell my readers about you, and you can take as much or as little time as you want.
Many things I could say about me. But, you know, I think in the context of authentic leadership, what I will say is it took me a really long time, a really long journey to click in to what feels like my right work in the world. Some people find that really fast. Some people don't find that so fast. I didn't find it so fast. And then when I found it, it took me a really, really long time to make it work. So my work is in the realm of applied mind-body science, in the realm of leadership and behavior change. It's not a widely known field. It's becoming more recognized, at least inside of the coaching and OD and leadership development professions. And it's certainly more recognized in the world of like trauma psychotherapy. But it's not a normal thing. And when I started 20 years ago, it was even way less normal than it is now. So building something new takes time. And I guess that with respect to kind of finding an authentic path through life and finding an authentic way to engage in one's professional life, that's what I would say is like part of my story is a long, long journey. And I'll let you dig into that and pick at that as you like. But that's what I'll say about myself for now.
Take me back to a little bit of the initial part of your journey and some of the things you've done. I know you've worked in traditional corporate roles. Tell me a little bit about that, and what were some of the signals in that life that started pointing you towards where you are now?
Great. So two things I would say. I grew up as an athlete and I grew up as a nerd, right? So I was super bookish and loved reading, loved science. I grew up in a medical family. So as an athlete that was surrounded by a lot of kind of conversation about medicine, I really thought actually I wanted to go into sports medicine. And when I went into college, I started down that path. But I'm so happy and lucky that I stumbled into a major called human biology, which was a pre-med major. But the human biology major at Stanford University, where I went to school, is actually an incredibly interdisciplinary program that sort of takes as its premise, you can't understand human beings without looking at them through the lens of both the natural and the social sciences. So what I got to do was study a lot of biology and psychology, and then sort of at the community level, a lot of anthropology and ecology. How do nature and culture influence one another? Now, lots of people take that into a pre-med kind of career, but because I absolutely couldn't pass organic chemistry, I decided not to go that route. I passed, but like barely. And people took this major and did all kinds of interesting things like legal policy making for children's health, as one example, right? Or education for cultural literacy, as another example. So people would go in all kinds of directions. And I was lucky that I did this very interdisciplinary thing. But then I got out into the world. Turns out that's like hard to make a living with that. And I couldn't figure out what to do. I had all of these, I have a very, even still, very wide range of interests. And I'm capable at many different kinds of things. So I didn't have like one shining talent that said, go in this direction. And I didn't have like one really strong interest that said, go in this direction. So I stumbled around for a long time and I banged my shins against the table. And because I was an athlete, because I had done a lot in the outdoors, I wound up starting an outdoor guide service with a bunch of friends. That was one of the things I did. As a small business owner, I learned a lot about kind of behind the scenes business management. And that's how I wound up at Intuit, where I have a friend who had worked there right out of college, software company that develops programs to help you manage your money personally or in small business. So I wound up at Intuit. I wound up doing a lot around small business education. That was interesting. I had done some education for youth earlier in my career, so high school level education. And ultimately that led me into the coaching field. But even in the coaching field, there was a lot that I was not satisfied with, a little bit suspicious of, not totally, it wasn't quite sitting right with me. And I had probably been coaching part-time for about 3 or 4 years. So I still have my job at Intuit. I was doing some coaching of leaders on the side. And then I sort of happened into, I'm not really sure how it happened, this very different orientation to coaching that's very physically oriented, very experiential, very mind-body applied. And at one point, as I was training in this methodology, in interacting with someone, I suddenly got, like, it was like everything went quiet inside of me. And I wouldn't say I heard a voice, but I had a knowing. And if I were to put that knowing into words, I would say the knowing in words was, oh, this is my work. This is my work. And interestingly, it harkened back to what I had done in my undergraduate education, which I had really loved, but which didn't necessarily equip me for like a normal job. So here I am with a very abnormal job that I've sort of created and invented myself. But it brings in all of my childhood interests, my college level interests, and even the stumbling around that I did early in my career that was sort of more in the world of business, where I could start to bring together mind-body science, applied like learning and behavioral change, and really take all of that as a lever to help people improve their lives.
You described this moment of hearing this quiet voice or getting this understanding of like, this is my work. There's a lot of people who are coming out of college or mid career even, and they're told, do what you love, find what you love. How was your search and your maybe awareness of being on a quest for what you love doing? How intentional was that?
Intentional and painful. So interestingly, I'm interested that you said that, because when I was in college, somebody older and wiser said to me, follow your heart. And I literally was mystified by that. I was like, what do you even mean, follow your heart? For me, that was incredibly difficult to understand what that even meant. Now, some people listening are going to be like, it's so obvious, you idiot, right? Like, some of you really know how to follow your heart. I did not, especially at that young age. And I write about it a little bit in my first book, Your Body is Your Brain, about how I came to kind of embody a very indecisive, uncertain way of being in the world, and how I eventually learned, we're not going to say, my partner in life would not say, like, I have not fully shifted out of that, but how I learned to become more decisive than I was, to be able to actually discern, oh, what does my heart actually want? And I think sometimes that can be really hard. So for me, it was a very intentional process. I did a lot of sort of reaching out to people that were doing work that I thought might be interesting or might be up my alley. That landed me a couple of very interesting jobs. Some of my favorite things that I did, one was teaching at a high school that was on an organic farm. So we got to do a lot of things outdoors. I taught in the science program. I did a little bit for them in the English program as well. And so that was very enriching. I also reached out to someone who was doing some very interesting things in the world of personal finance. And he and I actually wound up building an entire program together to educate people on how to make decisions about their money that were that was in alignment with their values. It was about authenticity, basically, right? So I reached out to people that I thought were doing interesting things. I tried a lot of different things. Gosh, I worked at an ice cream company. I did like filing at a medical records place. Like, I did anything and everything. And I was involved in starting a lot of things. So as I said, I started an outdoor guide service with some friends. And I also was involved in starting some networking organizations around sustainable business back when sustainable referred explicitly or exclusively to ecological sustainability. So how do you make business socially responsible in an environmentally responsible way? So it was a lot of experimentation, but also, as I said, it was painful. And it was painful because the whole time my peers were like landing normal jobs and having normal lives and, you know, getting married and buying houses and having kids and da 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 da. And I was not doing any of that. I was stumbling around feeling like I still don't know what I'm supposed to be doing on this planet. So there was a lot of internal struggle and sadness around that and fear that I might never land on something.
I'm really glad actually you said this, because the reason why I asked this question is that, of course, we all know, find something you love and you'll never work a day on your life. But that's a pretty tall order, and people find themselves in this situation where they have not found what they think they really love, and there's a sense of guilt. I'm interested in the process for navigating that, and in some advice that you might have for somebody who has not yet found what they're looking for, as you two would say.
I actually have a really strong opinion about that. So while career has always been a big part of my life and in many ways a big part of my identity, and so I really have made an incredible effort to find something that I love, my partner in life, my co-pilot, couldn't care less. His job is a job. He goes to the job to make some money. That's to pay the bills. The rest of his life is what's important to him. And he's really taught me a lot about being able to leave your work at the office, as it were. And also about just the dignity of work if you're doing work that helps someone else, that's important in the world, that's valuable, and you don't have to find work that fulfills your every psychological need. In fact, I have come to believe that, and this is not to knock finding a path, an authentic path through life, right? Finding an authentic path through life, I think, is totally essential. And for some of us, that authentic path runs through a career that we really love and feel on fire about and are excited about most days. It's usually not every day, right? Even for those of us who love our work. But there's something, I'm going to say, I almost want to say like elitist about that. We still need garbage collectors, you know, we still need jobs in society that aren't that fun, but that are absolutely essential to running our lives. And work doesn't have to be the be all and end all. Even if you love your work is not necessarily going to love you back, right? And so there are other things in life that are essentially important to us as individuals, as human beings, the people in your life that you love and the activities that bring you joy, the way you spend your time. And all of that is so, so important. And so for anyone who's listening, who's like, I haven't found it yet. I think you asked for a word of advice. Like my advice would be deep breath. As long as you're contributing, you're doing something of value. And it's not a requirement that we find work we love. It is a gift if we can do it.
So it's interesting you're talking about your partner's choices, because I do think there's a journey even to get to that intentional moment when it's, okay, this is how much work will be in my life. It's something actually that one of my former guests, Christina Wallace, wrote a fantastic book about it, which is called The Portfolio Life. The challenge is to navigate this situation of uncertainty where maybe our expectations of what we should be are still driven from the outside, whether it is our parents, your peers, who, as you said, are buying homes and making children. Let's talk about the moment when you kind of found this, okay, now I have my answer, which in your case is the work that you're doing now. So now you have your answer. And then, so what? What were the next key steps that you took at that point to bring this work to life?
In my particular case, that I would say required risk and courage and persistence. So again, I don't think this will be everyone's story necessarily, but in my case, I chose to devote my life to something that people largely didn't understand. Also, present day, largely still don't understand or tend to misunderstand. But today is totally different from 20 years ago when I started doing this. And so it really was very risky to make this decision. I'm going to kind of devote my time, my energy in this direction. I made some decisions that I would not advise anyone else to make, right? Which were like financially risky moves to commit money, to commit time. You know, I was working way more than full time, but earning way less than I had ever earned at any other job before. Is this going to pay off? Am I screwing myself up in the middle of my career when I actually don't even have that great of a like consistent track record in my career? I mean, I actually had some traction in the software world, which it was very financially rewarding. I wasn't totally satisfied there, but I could have kept doing that for a long time. The people were great. The projects were interesting, right? If I had chosen, I don't need my work to fulfill me. I just need to earn a paycheck. I probably could have gone that route. But for me, that actually wasn't the authentic route. For me, it was actually really important to me to have work that felt meaningful and that mattered and that I really enjoyed.
So you took all these financial risks and you had this safe opportunity on the other side. Do you remember when you started this path? Did you have a vision of what success on this path would be? What did that look like at the time?
The way that I articulated it to myself at the time was, I want to share somatics with others. So somatics is, I don't use that term very often these days, but it is kind of a shorthand for the applied mind-body science, very practical, pragmatic leadership development and behavior change that I teach and support people with. And the reason that I came to wanting to share this with other people is because my life was so positively changed. At the same time, I was incredibly skeptical, right? So I was experiencing vast positive changes. For example, during the period that I was kind of undergoing my own, I'll call it a somatic transformation, right? A period of really significant personal growth. That was also the period where I met my life partner. It was also the period where I settled into the work that I, you know, now have been doing for decades and will continue doing, I think, for the rest of my life. It will morph and change. It will grow and develop. But like, I'm on a path where I have an sort of an endless path of creative exploration. I started to get much better at following my heart in ways big and small, largely because I could actually start to feel my heart for the first time, something that I hadn't done much of when I was young for a whole variety of reasons. And so my vision was not, I'm going to build a company, I'm going to reach these financial goals, I'm going to reach this many clients or customers, I'm going to change a million people's lives. I did not articulate it in kind of traditional business objectives terms. I did articulate it as a vision for how the world could be different. I want people to have access to this very little known approach to developing themselves as leaders, because I know for myself, I've seen for my clients, and I believe for many other people, maybe not all, that this is an incredibly valuable methodology and path of learning. But as I said, I was super skeptical. So my life was being upended in all kinds of positive ways. But I was like, yeah, and this doesn't make any sense. Like, this is absolutely crazy. This doesn't make any sense. And so I went back to my academic roots and I started to look at, well, what's going on under the hood? So when I move in a different way, when I walk in a different way, when I stand in a different way, when I do a physical practice, like moving with a martial arts weapon, for example. When I do that 10 times a day, first thing in the morning, and I have a little phrase that goes with it, such as something like, I want to share somatics with others, I make different choices during my day. Why is that? That doesn't make sense to me. Like, what's the magic underneath this? That's why I wrote Your Body is Your Brain, because I personally needed convincing. And I needed to understand, what does the science have to say about how the role our body plays in behavioral learning? And what I learned was, oh my gosh, it's everything. And it's invisible to us most of the time. And when we make it visible, all of a sudden, we can do these crazy things, like striking with a martial arts weapon with your goal in mind, and holding your body in a particular way. And all of a sudden, whoa, I find myself taking risks in a way that I never have before. I find myself being more courageous in a way that I never had before. Why would that be?
That's a great summary. First of all, thank you for taking people through all the decision process, because one of the underlying theory of the podcast is that if you're clear about what you want and what your values are, over time, the results will follow. The fact that you were able to build a practice and make a living doing this is sort of proof of that. I'm also thankful for the fact that you shared the doubts that were coming at the time, because for you, it was somatics. Other people have different ideas or careers. Some may be even more traditional, but like, there's this fear, am I really able to do that? And so it's important to take that jump if there's something inside that really tells you to do that.
Hold your question, but I think if I were to give my younger self some advice, what I would say is, don't bet the farm, right? Like I did something where I closed the door behind me where it would have actually been really difficult to go back to the career I had previously been in. It wouldn't have been impossible, but very challenging. And that just brought me a tremendous amount of stress that I think was unnecessary. And if I had really earlier on, I have always done this, but if I had done more of it earlier, I would have really benefited, which is to say, I tested things in an iterative, collaborative process with people. So I learned what worked by working with people and being in that kind of iterative, collaborative process. And that's what eventually made it work. But I staked a lot on having it worked out when I didn't necessarily have grounded confidence and reason to believe that it would. And that caused me a huge amount of stress. So I would say, like, take baby steps. Maybe don't give up your day job, but develop proof of concept. And then when you're sure and you really have traction, then bet the farm.
That's a very fair statement. I definitely agree with that. I'd like to take like a few minutes just for the benefits of my listeners and the people who are looking for new ways to approach their leadership, or the way they work, the way they relate to others. If you could give us like a quick explanation of what somatics are and maybe two or three small practices that people could start doing like tomorrow morning.
Yeah. So somatics, which is a word that I really don't use. It's actually in the title of my book, Your Body is Your Brain. I talk about somatic intelligence, but fundamentally, I tend to steer a little bit away from that word because people think that, well, it can be a confusing word. Anyway, history of the word, it comes from the ancient Greek. It's very holistic. And it is fundamentally about having a combination of mental acuity and emotional agility and physical fitness and kind of a spiritual or moral compass. So the word somatics encompasses all of us. It is a very holistic word. But it's not widely understood that way. And it tends to be what more widely understood is, you know, oh, this is just something physical. I more often use the word embodiment, even though that points very much to something physical. Here's what I mean when I talk about embodiment. So, little known fact, embodiment is actually a constitutive part. It is essential to our cognition. And we usually use the word cognition to talk to like, well, that's we're thinking, like our intellect. But cognition is actually just about perception and decision-making. All organisms have the capacity for cognition, especially organisms that move around. Trees and plants we're less sure about, but especially organisms that move around, they perceive their environment and they make a decision about what to do in response to it. We do that with more than language. We actually do that through sensory, felt sense, physical ways. So an example is a carpenter knows how to connect the hammer to the head of the nail. I mean, these days they use air guns all the time, right? But let's just say you're hammering in a nail, right? And they can do that over and over. They know how to place the nail in the wood so that the wood doesn't split. And they know how hard to hit the nail to get it in three swipes of the hammer or one or five. And there's like a physical knowing in that. A baker has a knowing of when the bread dough is sufficiently kneaded. It's like, okay, now it's ready to like rest and rise or whatever. So an experienced baker will have that physical knowing. We either do or don't have or have to varying degrees a knowing of, for example, this group is with me and we're ready to go here. Or I haven't quite brought everyone into the fold. I need to talk to this person who's hanging back, right? And that's not an entirely, we may visually see that that person is hanging back. We may hear that they're not speaking up as much, right? But that's more than just a linguistically based knowing. It's also something we have a sense for or a feel. So we have a feel for our relationships in all areas of our life. And that physical felt sense knowing is an embodied kind of knowing. So another way I sometimes talk about this is like A cat knows when you've stepped on its tail. It doesn't have an idea about whether or not you've stepped. You know, it's not thinking in words, oh, my person just stepped on my tail. But it knows for sure, and it will turn around and like bite you or scratch you or say, don't do that, right? So there's a physical knowing, and we actually have this physical knowing as a constitutive part of how we understand the world. That's what somatics is. That's what embodiment is. And when we can, you know, most of us have spent decades in school training our intellect. That's great. Most of us have spent almost no time training the knowing that happens in our bodies, but we can't actually shut it off. It's operating 24/7. So we may as well learn how to use it, right? And get a lot smarter about how to tap that knowing and even tap that knowing to help us get more effective with whatever it is we're up to in the world. So I'm going to stop there. You asked for some practices, but I want to see if you have anything to say about that.
Yeah, I'm thinking of your example, and what is coming up is I'm a skier. I'm a ski instructor. And there's a physical training. Once I take my students on snow, I tell them how to bend their knees, where to feel their weight, you know, to feel the bottom or the foot completely flat on the ski. And then you can train them how to, by taking them, it's called mileage, taking them on the slopes over and over and learning to recognize their sensation, they can train their body to become skiers. What I'm hearing you say is that the same way that a skier learns to react to a certain sensation, change their weight, and gain their equilibrium, there's a way to train your body and through your body to train actually to react to the environment in a leadership or human relationship situation. Is that a fair parallel? Is it too simplistic?
No, it's not too simplistic. It's completely fair. I'm a skier too, so I know exactly what you're talking about, right? That you can explain it until you're blue in the face, but it's not until the skier feels it and goes, oh, my knees need just this amount of bend. And now I can kind of get down the slope in a way that feels less stiff or less scared, or right? So in the same way that you can train yourself to get a feel for, oh, here's how I carve a turn, right? Or here's how I just get down without terror. We can train ourselves to, I alluded to this in my own life, be more decisive. We can train ourselves to be more courageous. We can train ourselves, our whole selves, body included, to be more confident, to be more persuasive, to be more quick to action and less hesitating or procrastinating, right? So all of these skills that we need in our professional lives to succeed in the ways that we may target success for ourselves, of course we hold ourselves back because we have habits that we've developed over a lifetime. And you could read every self-help book. You could read my book. That's fine. Read my book. It's not actually the thing that's going to help you change. It'll maybe help you understand some ways to change. But we don't actually change through new ideas. New ideas can give us really super useful insight, but we change through shifting our embodied habits. So one of the ways that I tend to talk about this is awareness creates choice, practice creates capacity. So when you have an insight, you have new awareness. Oh, I have this habit of procrastinating, and it turns out that I procrastinate in the following ways, and it's da-da, and here's how it holds me back, and this is why I procrastinate, because my mom procrastinated, and da-da-da-da, right? And you got all the reasons and all the explanations. That doesn't actually help you not procrastinate. It helps you see what's going on. So awareness creates choice. Oh, I see that this is my habit. Or let's use something else. Let's use, I hesitate to offer what I have, right? Whether you're an entrepreneur and you have something specific that you want to offer into the world, or whether you're inside of a company and you hesitate to speak up and offer your ideas, right? So I hesitate to offer what I have. Well, how do you develop more capacity to speak up and make that offer or extend your hand or extend out? And you, I mean, you can see me on the video right now. Do you know, right? Like I am actually physically extending my hands. And so what happens if you practice over and over making an offer while extending your hands? I have something to say. I have something to offer. I have something here that could be of value potentially, right? And that you do that enough times that you start to wire into your whole physical being, your whole neuromusculature, a different way of reaching out to people where you're more relaxed, you're less stiff, you're less hesitant, you're less fearful, you're less afraid. And all of a sudden you have more confidence, more courage in what it is, in offering what it is you have to offer in the world.
I know this is practice that takes long discipline, et cetera, but for somebody who is listening right now and curious about it, what are a couple of like simple exercises that they can say, okay, let's try this for a couple of weeks and see what happens?
Yeah. So I want to say one thing about what you said first, which is like, this can take a long time. It's useful to think about this. Like you wouldn't go to the gym one day, do some sit-ups, walk out and say, I have abs. You wouldn't even go to the gym for 2 weeks and walk out and be like, I have abs. The body takes time and repetition and practice to learn, to rewire, to change its neuromusculature. And so it's useful to think about this as a long-term practice. I'll give you two specific things that are really easy interventions. So one thing that you can do, if you're a person that tends to feel like spun up, caught in your head, maybe worried a lot of the time, and you feel like I would like to feel more centered and grounded, a very, very simple thing you can do is put some flat lentils in your shoes, between your socks and your shoes. They will move around, wiggle around in there. They'll help bring your attention to the sensations at your feet. And the purpose of doing that is to help you pay attention to physical sensation in your feet and legs. Doing that will actually help you feel more connected to the ground, less spun up, less in your head. You'll be able to feel your feet and settle some of the sort of fast-moving metabolic energy that might be moving through you. So that's one very simple practice. Another very simple thing that you can do. This is something you can do as an intervention and also as a practice. So what I mean by that is in a moment where you're particularly stressed out, this intervention works really well. As an ongoing practice, it can change your level of stress reactivity. So it's something that you would have to step out of the room to do. So if you're in a meeting and you find yourself getting worked up, this is not the thing that you would do. But you could step out and just like excuse yourself and go to the bathroom for 1 minute. And that's all you really need. And the intervention is to stretch your face. So I've done this a bunch of times on video. I don't know if people will not be able to see me on the podcast, but like I'm wiggling my jaw. You could do this now too now, Dino. Like before you start, just check in with yourself and go like, how am I feeling now? You might be relaxed, you might be eager, you might be interested. Like, what do you notice about your sort of baseline state? Where are you starting?
Right now, I'm actually very relaxed and fascinated by all this. It's really resonating with some of my core belief around connecting body and mind. I'm just listening eagerly and intently.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, you look really engaged. So let's do this together. I'll talk you through it. Anyone listening can follow along. And we're going to make some funny faces. So just like, wiggle your jaw, kind of make your lips all funny, like tighten your lips and make your lips push out, jaw back and forth, open wide. You can even get your tongue involved, stick your tongue out if you like, tongue to each side. Get your cheeks involved. So you're tightening, squeezing your cheeks. And then notice as you do that, your eyes start to tighten up. And you can move your eyes one side to the other, or maybe up and down, and you're still moving your jaw, your eyes, and now your forehead, and your whole face is getting involved, and squinching, and then stretching, and then squinching, and then stretching. And notice whether you're breathing. And if you're not breathing, go ahead and take a breath and keep wiggling your face. If you're a person that can move your scalp and ears, you can involve your scalp and ears. Oh, look at that. Pretty impressive. Deep breath, deep exhale. And just check in, Dino, and let me know if you feel the same or if anything has changed.
Well, I'm even more relaxed than I was before.
Yeah. And do you just only feel that in your face?
No, it's really actually in my chest.
Yeah. So one of the reasons this works, people will say, take a deep breath and count to 10, right? Or take 10 deep breaths. That's great. One of the reasons this works is it's actually intervening in the same system. So when we take a deep breath, what we're doing is we're intersecting with our autonomic nervous system, the part of us that does many things, maintains homeostasis in the body, also fight, flight, freeze, right? So we're intersecting with that in a voluntary way when we take a deep breath. But it can be really hard to remember to take a deep breath in a situation where we're stressed out. It's less hard to remember to go make funny faces. Turns out that the neuromusculature in your face, head, and neck also connects into the autonomic nervous system in a very direct way. A lot of our stress response gets expressed in our facial expressions, right? We'll have a furrowed brow, or we'll be frowny faced, right? Like all kinds of things can happen on our face when we're stressed out, also when we're happy. So doing a bunch of kind of muscular exercises on your face where you're tightening up and you're stretching, right? And wiggling and moving, it can release some of the tension in the neuromuscular system that is being held because of stress, and that will move into your whole autonomic nervous system. It will generally relax you throughout your body. So you said you felt more relaxation in your chest. So that's a great intervention in the moment when you're stressed out, but the way that it would help you most is to do it every day, 5 times a day. Your stress, your entire stress system will be trained to a different, lower level of reactivity.
This is fantastic. I will use it with all my clients. I'm going to start all my coaching sessions with this starting going forward from today. This is a perfect spot to finish this conversation. So you mentioned your book, if you wouldn't mind saying your title again, and then where else can people find you online?
Great. Okay. So the book is called Your Body is Your Brain. It's fundamentally about finding purpose and building resilience and developing stronger relationships. And I originally intended to write it for leaders, but since the body comes with us everywhere we go, it wound up being about life as a whole. So it's relevant to leadership and workplace. It's also relevant to, you know, your everyday life and relationships. Check it out if you're interested. The easiest place to find me is at embright.org. So that's embright.org. And you will find a ton of free resources there, lots of other podcasts that you can listen to, all kinds of things that you can download. And Dino, since you asked about practices, I'll point people to one in particular. There's something on the Embright website called the Stress to Serenity Challenge. It's completely free. It will take you through 7 days. I think it's like 7 sessions over 14 days of learning a particular centering practice that we didn't have time to talk about here. But it's another one, like putting lentils in your shoes or stretching your face. One that's maybe a little more elaborate and helps you really center around your sense of purpose or what you care about. So some listeners may find that interesting, and I would point them to that as one of the free resources on the Embright website that might be cool to check out.
It will be on the website on the episode page. Let's move on to the personal section of the podcast. The first question is, what is an interest or a passion or hobby that you have outside of your work, and how has that impacted your work?
Well, you mentioned that you're a skier. I'm a skier too, although it's actually been a long time since I've done much downhill skiing. I'm much more of a Nordic skier these days, and I like a lot of backcountry and Nordic skiing. How has it affected my work? There's a group of people that has been trying to get together to do like embodiment, neuroscience, philosophy, and telemark skiing. It would be so cool if we could pull that off. We haven't yet, but I think in a more concrete way, how has it affected my work? I would say all of my athletic experiences in my life have informed the mind-body approach to leadership development that I do now, especially around making change through sustained, repeated practice. But I would caution myself and others to say, like, a big learning for me was that athleticism is not the same as embodied knowing. And there's an appendix in the book where I actually talk about this. We have to get really good at sort of physical performance as athletes, but that's not the same as discerning what our body is telling us. So, like, feeling, how do I follow my heart? What does my heart want? That's something very different from athletics. So this work lends itself to people who, like, are really interested in athletics, and it also really lends itself to people who aren't, because really both of us, like, we need that same learning.
Fantastic. So now we get to my favorite question of the podcast, which is, every era has business cliches or expressions or business phrases that get so overused that they lose their meaning. Which is the one that drives you crazy?
Can I pick like six?
Yes.
I have so many. First of all, not everything needs to be taken to the next level. We do not need to go always to the next level. I am so tired of let's take it to the next level. I can't even say, but it's like fingernails on chalkboard for me. And I think partly because it's empty, partly because it's almost like gamifying life. Like, to me, it sounds like let's level up in the video game of life here. And I know for some people that would be very meaningful. For me, it drives me nuts. Let's just not take it to the next level. Let's just be very content with the beautiful gifts that we have in our life today, right now. Can I share?
You can go all six if you want.
I'm not going to tell you all six, but I do just have so many. People use the term pivot to mean like the ever so slightest change. And I really don't think that is the intention behind that word. Not everything is a pivot. A pivot is like, we've really been going one direction. Now we're going to go 90 or 180 degrees the other direction. It's going to take a big shift. And anyway, that's my interpretation of it. And it kind of drives me nuts when people will say, like, let's pivot to the next natural question to talk about in this podcast, right? Which you delightfully did not do. So thank you for that. There's another one that's actually bothered me for a long time. I will hear the word, I think I alluded to this earlier. I'll hear the word sustainable used to talk about, you know, a sustainable marriage, which frankly doesn't sound like any kind of marriage that I particularly want to be in. I mean, great if it's sustained, but let's have it be like happy, joyful, and fulfilling as well. Or a sustainable business, meaning one that can be financially sustained over time, right? And if you look back at the history of the way that word has been used in the business environment, it came out of the Brundtland Commission in the 1990s, where they were really looking at what is required to sustain life on this planet, right? What is ecological sustainability, and how do businesses either contribute to that or, in many cases, completely erode our capacity to sustain life on this planet? So I think that word gets used much more broadly than it was originally intended. And then unfortunately, it results in kind of a lot of greenwashing and a lot of, on the one hand, fantastic enthusiasm for what we really need to do to sustain life on the planet. And on the other hand, I think sometimes some very cynical misuse of the term. So, okay, those are some pet peeves.
All right, final question. I call it food for the body or food for the soul. And on the body side, if you go that side, it's either a recipe or a drink that you love right now. Or if you go the soul route, something artistic. It could be a book. It could be a piece of music, a painting, a movie, a play, a sculpture, something that touches you.
I really want to give you six of those too, but I'm going to respect your listener's time. You know what I'll say? I'll give you two forms of art. One is actually a woman who makes puzzles. I've never been that much into puzzles, but she's gotten me into puzzles. Her name is Elena Essex. I'll give you a link that you can share with your listeners. And I just think her artwork to me is incredibly beautiful. And I love doing her puzzles. It's a very sort of a way to let my brain rest, and I'll just listen to music and do a puzzle, or sometimes listen to a podcast and put a few pieces in place. And I also love puzzles for like somebody comes by, and it's a great way to be doing something with your hands, but also just, you know, like chatting. And then the other thing, that the other art that's been in my life lately that I've really enjoyed is something called Zentangle, which is a really simple, sweet, meditative doodling practice. And I've found it to be quite relaxing and quite illuminating. So two food for the soul.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been like a great conversation.
I've really, really enjoyed this. I so appreciate your questions and also what you're up to around helping people find an authentic path for themselves. So best wishes to everyone listening on that journey.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, find a friend who may like it and tell them that they should listen to it. Also, you may have listened to every single episode so far, in which case I am really, really thankful. But most likely you haven't. So go find a few others and listen to them. As usual, if you really like the show, tell all your friends and post about it on social media. Every little bit helps. Make sure you're subscribed to the show on your favorite listening platform so you don't miss any episode. And if you listen on a platform that allows ratings and reviews like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, Good Pods, please leave us a stellar rating and a review. 5 stars. Stay tuned, because after the credits, I will play a song by Susan Cattaneo, one of Boston's best Americana singer-songwriters. For more information on the episode and all the links, go to the website, al4ep.com, spelled with the number 4. You can email me at dino@al4ep.com. Make sure you follow the podcast on whatever social media platform you use. On Twitter and Instagram, the handle is @al4edp with the letter D. And on Facebook, look for Authentic Leadership for Everyday People. This episode was produced by me, Dino Cattaneo, and it was recorded remotely using Squadcast. I partially edited in the script, and then there were additional edits by Pro Podcast Solutions. The theme music was composed, produced, and arranged by Nicholas Cattaneo, who also played keyboards and drums, with Tony Savarino on guitar and Jesse Williams on bass. And now, here's a song by Susan Cattaneo. It's called A Place Called Love.
Keeps blowing down a long stretch of highway at the mercy of the wind. Wanna settle down somewhere, yeah, that's where I'm going, but I can't seem to get there from the places I've been. There's no map, no signs saying you'll find love here, so I just keep on passing through everywhere. I lived a long time in heartache, and I ain't going back there. Spent a few nights in paradise, but that got me nowhere. I was lost in the state of lonely. Nothing's ever felt like home to me. I've been close, but not close enough. Shotgun, and she never stops whispering, girl, just believe. I could walk in some dusty old road stop and suddenly know in a heartbeat I found what I need. One right turn somewhere, someone, someday, and I know that's where I'm meant to stay. Back there, spent a few nights in Paris. lived a long time and hard.